Now, you might want to ask, who cares about information systems when we're up to our ears with other problems, such as, I guess you can identify with these, falling attendance, reduced contributions, increasing costs, and on top of everything else, our members aren't coming to our contemporary Eucharist. So who needs information systems? The answer is, you do. The information system is designed to help you solve the kinds of problems you face in your parish. So we won't philosophize about it. We're going to try to give you some practical tips, some things that you can take home and possibly implement after the proper gestation period. But getting a little bit ahead of our story, let me just say that this management information system and the many benefits are not only relevant for you in the parish and those of you who are going into the parish, but long overdue for a variety of reasons. But perhaps I'd better set the stage before we get ahead of ourselves. How many of you have read the article in the latest issue of Seminar called The 21-Gun Approach? A few of you. Okay. I assume that many of you wouldn't have, so I want to do some backing up and setting the stage to make this whole thing more relevant. I've had a chance on a number of occasions to expose these kinds of ideas to groups such as you, this group, and the September 9th seminar is the end result of a number of exposures over the years. The purpose of that presentation and the article was to tell a story designed to have pastors and, in some cases, laymen begin thinking in terms of modern marketing techniques and what they can do for you in terms of church program and create viable programs, in fact. And I guess that's what we're up to today. Let me use some of the key ideas from that article to build a base on which to develop our thoughts. Marketing is my field, and marketing has to do, or is that part of business which is concerned with getting the right product to the right consumers at the right price and at the right time. There are four marketing variables: the product, the place or the location of selling, the price, and promotion. We don't care about this, but it does kind of set the framework for the kinds of ideas we're talking about. We include such things as advertising, price determination, sales promotion, the little things you get in the mail, free from Procter & Gamble. That's part of marketing, I'm sorry to say. Packaging and so on. A lot of people have criticized marketing because they say it perverts values. It creates waste. It generally leads to bringing out the worst in people. Some of the people who have said this are John Kenneth Galbraith, Vance Packard, and now Ralph Nader seems to be making the most noise. And they have championed the consumer movement against these kinds of abuses and overages. And rightly so. As a marketer, as a marketing consultant, and a practicing marketer, I can share these kinds of concerns. There have been a lot of abuses. But there's a lot of good in marketing. A lot of things do happen because of it. And we'll try to spend our time looking at the good part of it. Now, the evidence that it works is quite abundant. Some obvious examples are the automobile industry. Ford spent a lot of money telling us it had a better idea, and apparently it worked because it helped sell a lot of Fords. Or take the electronic calculator, the pocket model. A year or two ago, we didn't know they existed. And now bridge clubs are using the tally scores. You know, everybody has one, and those who have them want a second one. It's a sort of a status symbol. I don't have one. Something's wrong. Or take We Try Harder. Where was Avis before they started building a campaign based on We Try Harder? Or Saturday morning TV. Anybody with small children recognizes the potential bankrupting effect of television advertising directed at children. Buy one today, only $24.95. You know, don't be left out. Barbie or her boyfriend. Or take Charmin Tissue. Mr. Whipple has spent a lot of time, and Charmin has spent a lot of money telling us not to squeeze the Charmin. And it's almost part of our vocabulary, you know, or try it, you'll like it. That's what marketing has done to us. Are you happy about that? One of the negatives, I think, is shown in this cartoon, which happily is right side up. The egg timer is pinging, the toaster is popping, the coffee pot is perking. Is this it, Alice? Is this the great American dream? Well, from a marketer standpoint, yes. Now, marketing isn't all powerful. It can't sell all things. The overworked example is the Edsel. It didn't do what it was supposed to do. Also, I believe the figures are something like 80% of the new firms entering business today or 80% of the new products brought out today will fail inside of 2 years. It takes, according to one study, 400 new product ideas to result in one viable, marketable, successful product. 400 to 1 is not a great batting average. Now, why does this happen? A product or a service or a program in the church will succeed only if it provides consumers with satisfaction. We'll call them parishioners, if you will, with satisfaction of some kind. Again, we'll get back to this. A key idea in marketing today is called the new marketing concept. It's not new anymore, so we're calling it the marketing concept. In a few words, this idea suggests that the marketer must begin his efforts with the consumer and the consumer's wants. In business term, a manufacturer no longer makes a product and then tries to unload it on the unsuspecting consumer. Today, he goes to the consumer first to determine his needs. What do you need? And then he builds a product to fill that need. The rallying cry is something like, the consumer is king. And in modern marketing terminology, he is. But in order to effectively serve the consumer, the marketer, or in your case, the church leader, has to know what the consumer wants or needs. To do this, he has to be able to identify the consumer. And to effectively sell to him, we have to be able to create the product, the proper product and the proper message to fill these needs. That is a statement which we can make with fairly total certainty is that the market, the U.S. market, is not homogeneous. We don't have a typical consumer. We have hundreds or thousands or tens of thousands of groups of homogeneous consumers. Evidence might be shown in the variation in automobiles. How many automobile variations are there? Thousands or tens of thousands if we start including color and fabric and so on. Or the number of brands of coffee or so on. If there were a typical consumer, he would buy a blue Ford Galaxy two-door with AM radio and that's about it, right? But we don't have that kind of situation. If there were a homogeneous market, we wouldn't have such extensive variety because it wouldn't be needed. Some automobile plant manager said a couple years ago in Time magazine that if he ran his assembly plants, his corporation's assembly plants, around the clock, 365 days a year, they would not build the same car twice. I haven't figured that out in terms of how many variations that is, but it's a lot. Okay, what we're talking about here is market segmentation. We have a total market, and we're going to break it into segments which are reachable, which are homogeneous. Whether it's automobiles or coffee or toothpaste or what deodorants, that's a great example. Each one of these things appeals to a particular segment. And after we finish segmenting a market, we end up with a group called a target market. This is one of these thousands or tens of thousands of homogeneous segments at which we're going to aim our effort. Okay, a target market we could define as a group of consumers toward which we aim our attempts to sell. And here's an important and, it is large enough to be served at a profit. Now that's a business concept, but that same concept applies to you, as we'll see later. Well, that later is really going to be loaded, isn't it? We're going to see everything later. Now, what I'm saying is that you or I are not target markets. As a member of a larger group which can be economically served, whatever that means, we can be part of a target market. And the selection of a target market is a managerial function, which today, happily, is based more and more on marketing research, which is designed to identify these homogeneous groups and the needs of the homogeneous groups. It's important to the success of a firm or to the success of a product that it realize that what is normally or what was normally considered to be a large market is not. It's a series of market segments and target markets. That, in a nutshell, is a very vital realization. The concept of a mass market, of a mass audience, is a myth. It doesn't exist. It never did. It's a handy term, but it's not really managerially very, very useful. But this idea could, Sherboygan flu, excuse me. This idea could be illustrated with a particular product, so let's do it. Let's say you were in the refrigeration business. This is a marketing grid or a market grid which shows the variations in possible uses of refrigeration. For example, we have geographic differences from east to midwest to Pacific and so on. We have the place of use of the application from home, food stores, wholesalers, restaurants, hospitals, churches aren't on there, are they? Trains, ships, planes, they all use refrigeration in some way, shape, or form. Now, if your job was to create a unit, a refrigerator, what would you create? Will it be a compact thing that has stowage capacity so that a rocking boat won't dislodge stuff? Will it be a large thing for restaurants? Is it a different shape thing for food stores or what? Well, there is no one refrigerator, right, to serve all these needs. And what are we talking about? Food in a cold state, or frozen food, or soft drinks, or window air conditioning, it's refrigeration. So we have here a reasonable number of possible market segments which can be served. The important realization is that they're not all served with the same product. The needs with regard to style, shape, capacity, durability, all these variables are different in each one of these little boxes. So each one of these boxes represents a target market, right? Now, same thing is true for automobiles, men's suits, in fact, anything you can name. Let's say we asked you to build a man's suit. What would you make? What color? What size? What style? Just for men, period. You'd be in trouble, right? Now, if we would to define a market cell or a market segment as Lutheran pastors over 50 years of age living in large Midwestern cities with an average waist of 40 inches, you'd have a pretty good place to begin, wouldn't you? That description is specific enough to facilitate some kind of meaningful decisions about the product. Now, normally we categorize target markets in terms of demographic characteristics, age, sex, stage in the life cycle, occupation, race, geographic location, and so on. Lately, we're getting into psychological or psychographic descriptions, which possibly are a little bit more telling. And we're talking about parameters such as wants, personality, reference groups, motives, attitudes, and things like this. We're not really doing much with it because it's pretty tough to get a handle on some of these ideas. But at least it's coloring the way we look at it. This one, I guess, is relevant. New Yorker magazine. Double scotches for me and my super ego and a glass of water for my id, which is driving. Okay? And that kind of is the thing we're looking at now in marketing. Let's look at the behavioral components of the consumer so it's better to serve these kinds of variables. Now, these kinds of data, whether it's behavioral or demographic, we can attempt to specify a cell which we can now reach in our program. Another way of saying what we're doing here is that we're trying to give the consumer what he needs. A central concern in the marketing process is effective promotion, or let's call it communication. And this bears heavily on the need for information, which is what we're talking about today. Communication can, as defined by somebody, is tell it to sell it. We can't sell it unless we tell it, and we have to tell it properly. And this is what's involved primarily. Okay, tell it to sell it. I had to use that because that's my son. That I'm going to show that to his first date, the one he brings home the first time. The communications process begins with a sender who encodes a message. A message is transmitted. A receiver decodes it and ends up with some kind of a mental idea of what the sender had hoped to accomplish. But there's something missing here. What's missing is shown in the same chart, which includes feedback. We don't really know whether the encoding process and the decoding process are resulting in the same image without feedback. We need it. And too many communications don't involve feedback. We could replace the word feedback with the word information. And by golly, we're right back to our topic, aren't we? Now, periodically, we will find that encoding and decoding do not result in the same mental image in the mind of the source or the sender and the receiver. Why not? Well, one why not is shown, same general scheme, but shown in these little eggs up here, which are labeled the frame of reference and field of experience of the source, the frame of reference and field of experience of the receiver. The extent to which these spheres overlap, okay, these two frames of reference or fields of experience overlap, that is the extent to which communication will be effective. So if you're using terminology that means something to you but not to them because you don't share the same field of experience or frame of reference, communication is likely to be faulty. But now if you haven't had the same experiences, how do you accomplish this artificially? Can you think of a hot word that we might use to describe that? How can I adopt your point of view without really living your life? Empathy. Sure, why not? We're going to have to vicariously simulate these frames of reference. We're going to try to force the overlap through empathy. We're going to put ourselves in the other guy's shoes. And now we can talk to him in terms that he'll react to, the way we want him to react. But how do I empathize with you if I don't know who you are? So again, information is needed. I must understand you and who you are and what you need and the way you think before I can talk to you. Otherwise, miscommunication occurs. Now, what happens when miscommunication occurs? Here's an ad that appeared in the Advertising Age in a column which was labeled Ads We Can Do Without. Some advertising man who I have to write and commend. This is an ad that ran in some West Coast newspaper. You too can turn water into wine. It's a homemaking wine kit. Well, maybe for a certain group of California residents, this communicates, but it obviously is offensive to a lot of people. I doubt if there are too many who groove on this in this particular room. Bad communication, misuse of symbols, bad overlapping in the spheres of experience, and a lousy job of empathy. Well, let's take the word tank. If I say tank to you, what do you think of? You're welcome. Only in Milwaukee. When I say tanks, what do you think of? Does that create an image? How about that? Is that a tank? Yeah. Is that a tank? Yes. That's a developing tank with thin layer chromatography. But they're both the same idea. Without the shared experiences, we can't really use these kinds of symbols effectively. Or the use of words. This is a classic. Sex, sex, sex. Is that all you can talk about? Is the caption. S-E-C-T-S. That's a classic Esquire piece. And even if it doesn't belong, I use it. It's good. Now, a good story can be made for any product or any program if you can empathize, if you can communicate the concepts that are important to the buyer of, or the user of, the involved person of the product. Here is one that's a little bit not too clear, I guess. Here's a nail. What can you say about a nail? Okay, this is what was said about it. Tempered steel nail will penetrate poured concrete. That's a user benefit. The fluting gives the nail a screw-like grip, won't pull out. Who ever thought about that when you look at a nail? Good as it is, you can buy a pound of these nails for 49 cents. They're approximately 100 in a pound. We end up over here, I guess. This is shown about three times actual size to clarify the detail. Notice the lengthwise fluting on the shaft. It prevents splitting whether you're driving into concrete or wood. The head will not split off. See how it is shaped and to countersink itself on the final blow of the hammer. And the final thing is moral. There's no such thing as a dull product. Only dull approaches to interesting products. So what's your problem? Okay? Now, if you can make a nail interesting, we could back up a slide or two and make that thin layer developing tank interesting. And we can certainly take the pork chop dinner and make it interesting if we're using the kinds of concepts that are important to the potential user. And if not, what happens? Okay? Because of you, my darling, I've never had an ulcer. I've never needed a psychiatrist. When I poured out my troubles, you listened. When I ranted and raved, you listened. Thank you, my angel, for listening. And she says, who listens? And too often the programs that we're involved in end up just that way. Who listened? We weren't really communicating. Let's digress for just a minute and look at the kind of thing that we're talking about. Let me illustrate it with this example. Some dimensions or variables which have been measured in a semantic differential test for beer are, get this now, beer, what is it? An amber fluid. No. It has aftertaste, aroma, bitterness, body, carbonation, foam, lightness, strength, sweetness. Those are all terms which can be applied to beer. And if we're talking about wine, the list would go even, well, it would be a lot longer than this one. But what has to be stated here is that while these variables have intrinsic characteristics, which can be varied, we can vary bitterness and lightness and so on, they can also take on the values that marketing communication gives them. And how do we do it? We put a bottle around it, we put a label on the bottle, we create an advertising campaign that connects the bottle with some kinds of characteristics, and by George, we have a product, which may not be physically different from any other product in terms of beer. But you and I believe it has different capabilities and characteristics. Is anybody from Budweiser here? We shouldn't use this example in St. Louis, I guess. Now, how you rate your brand, your favorite brand, on these characteristics depends in part upon your senses. You will react physically or physiologically to these characteristics. But perhaps even more importantly, your perception of these qualities depends on the image that's been created for you by marketers, advertising, and like that. The brewer tells you it's light, so it's light. Now, if we fail to observe these basic ground rules, failure results. A classic example is the well-worn expression, if you make a better mousetrap, the world will beat a path to your door. Classic mousetrap, regular mousetrap, right? Here's the way it looks schematically. We've all been familiar with these things. A firm created a better mousetrap, and it proved that this statement was invalid. The market did not respond to it. No path to the store or to the door followed. Here's a better mousetrap. This is a design. It's a real thing. It's not just a figment of some professor's imagination. The firm had very carefully researched mice habits. It researched the eating habits, crawling habits, resting habits, and preferred size of holes. And they had experimented with a number of models, and this is the one that worked best for the mouse. It was ideally suited for totally destroying unwanted mice. The trap worked like a charm, but it missed the base in terms of market acceptance. What went wrong? Why didn't people beat a path to their retailers? After the fact, analysis shows that urbanites are the largest users of mouse traps. Farmers have cats. Now, how is it used? The husband sets the trap before retiring. The reasons they found were that mice are nocturnal animals, small children are not. Women don't like to become involved in setting the trap for two reasons. Traps are mechanical, and she's afraid of mechanical things, and man is a traditional hunter in our society. So what happens? The mouse is caught during the night, and it falls to mom to take care of that dirty old trap. She had to relieve the trap of the corpse. Dad had to get to work on time, and by the time the trap was found, she was home alone. Since she didn't want a dead mouse around all day, she had to either clean the trap or do what she normally did with the old trap, just drop it in the bag and throw it in the garbage. And here's the problem. The trap looked too good to throw away. It cost only a few cents more than that wooden trap we saw just a minute ago, but it looked too good. So if she cleaned the trap, every time she saw the trap, she would think of the mess. If she threw it away, she would have the guilt feeling of wasting something valuable. In any event, she ordered her hunter never to buy that brand of trap again. And after a small sales spurt at the outset, it dried up. The product went off the market. What did we learn? We learned that the mouse is not the consumer of the product. And what they had the mice pegged, but they didn't have the consumer pegged. Why? Because they did not ask the consumer what were his needs in a mouse trap, or how would they react to this trap. Let's put out some into homes and measure the results. Harvard's Theodore Levitt has called a certain failure syndrome marketing myopia. Marketing myopia is a concept which suggests that the firm, the manufacturer, is product-oriented, not consumer-oriented. And some of the examples that he uses are the following. Railroads were in trouble for a number of years, not because the need for transportation was filled by others, cars, trains, planes, telephones, boats, but because the railroads didn't fill the need, as shown by cars, planes, trains, and boats. Theodore Levitt argues that the railroads should have pioneered airlines. They should have pioneered pipelines, telephone systems, and so on. They were in the train business, not the transportation business. They gave the market away. They didn't lose it to somebody else. Hollywood is another example. Hollywood had a Dickens of a time when TV was born because Hollywood said, we're in the motion picture business, not in the entertainment business. So they did not fill the need that was filled by others. And the result is possible economic disaster. Here's a real-life example of management thinking it knows what the consumer wants and defining it in terms that are comfortable to the management of the firm but not to the consumer. This publication is a bibliography on thin layer chromatography, free. It was sent to 10,000 key chemists on a mailing list because it was felt that this service would help endear the chemist to this company's product, which happened to appear in ads inside. Along the way, at my insistence, the firm asked the recipients of this bibliography to respond with a postcard if they wished to continue receiving it, free of charge, right? How many responded out of 10,000? Less than 500. Why? Because it wasn't filling a need. It was filling a printer's need to print 10,000 copies, but it wasn't doing anything for the recipient. Later on, we decided that there really should be a charge for this thing, because it was quite valuable. Annotated bibliographies should not be free. So we again asked the 500 so-called subscribers of this publication and about 12,000 chemists at large if they would pay $6 a year for it. And now the 500 copies dropped to 150. Why? Because management never bothered to ask until that time, is this useful to you? Do you want it? And when they found out the facts, they are no longer publishing it. Or there's another one, laboratory budget stretcher sale. It's going to make $1 million for the company. Save money for limited time only. Nobody bought anything on sale. Why not? Well, nobody ever asked the researcher whether he cared about saving money. And it turned out he didn't. He didn't have profit responsibility. Again, a great program, a great idea down the drain because the needs of the customer or consumer were not considered properly. Somebody once said that the secret of good showmanship is giving people what they want just before they think they want it. This is true of good marketing, and good marketing brings us now to a church-related example. The same words that we've been using are put into a different frame of reference, the church, by Stan Freeberg in a series of spots he created for the United Presbyterian Church in America, I believe about 5, 6, 7 years ago, the first spots were released. Freeberg said, and this is a quote from what he has said on the flip side of the commercials, the American public has been brainwashed by the $20 billion spent annually by Madison Avenue in an attempt to get them to buy some today. The American consumer has learned to tune out these attempts to sell. He's becoming immune to commercials. Freeberg felt that in that 1 minute they had to communicate with the outsider, which was his focus, his target market, was the unchurched, he had just 60 seconds to tell his story. And he felt the best way to tell it was on non-religious radio programming. Do unchurched people listen to religious radio? Probably not. Why should they? So Freeberg said, let's create spots that communicate with the outsider in terms he can understand in a position, time slot, on a radio station that appeals to the person he's talking to, which happened to be the young, newly married American family. That was his target market. Now check these Freeberg statements from one of his radio commercials. Announcer, but your name, it's just penciled in here. Freeberg says, well, there's a big turnover in personnel. You know how it is. Announcer, well, that's just about how it is in life, isn't it? How's that? We're all just penciled in. Now, can a young, married, striving businessman kind of comprehend this idea of being penciled in on a business card? You know, we're all pretty temporary. Yeah, he can relate to it. Or the other one that said, well, we'll travel along the church one of these days. How about 2 weeks from Sunday? Freeberg says, oh, I never planned that far ahead. 2 weeks, why, the whole world could blow up by then. And the author says, that's right. And the tagline on these things was, where'd you get the idea you can make it all by yourself? Doesn't it get a little lonely sometimes out on that limb without him? Well, you may not like the style that he's using to communicate, but is he communicating a specific message to a specifically and well-defined target market? Absolutely. Again, it can work in this kind of a program. Now, what we're doing here really is we're using a very specific technique to talk to a very specific group of people. We're not shotgunning, we're rifling. That's not related to the presentation, but it looks better than the last one. Now, putting it again, following through with the church focus, just as it's easy to shotgun a mass market, it's also easy to shotgun your congregation, and I will maintain that you don't have a congregation. You have a series of congregational segments. If you create something and shotgun a congregation, you will not be as effective as if you create specific programs to communicate to specific congregational segments. The point to be made in any line here is that just as effective marketing uses market segmentation as a means of identifying and understanding and focusing on market segments, we can use those same techniques in the church. How many times have you heard some of these things? We just don't get enough support for our programs. Or no one came to our pancake supper. Or our discussion group was a total failure. And rightly so. Why shouldn't it be? Many programs fail, but they're almost guaranteed to fail because they were designed by committee people or board members or pastors, and they were not designed with the congregation in mind. Somebody had a great idea, and a program was born. We've seen all kinds of reactions to different kinds of programs to show that we're not a homogeneous congregation. Example, after a particularly interesting contemporary communion service, a number of tearful members filed out of the church, bemoaning it as a hippie farce, irreligious, offensive. Other people filed out with tears in their eyes, saying it was the most moving experience they'd ever had. What's the moral? The moral is that we don't have a homogeneous congregation. Or the Keys for Christ drive in our church, some people responded by saying, what happened to the gospel? Or next we'll be marching. We didn't tell them we'd already been marching. And other people to that same program said, why did it take you guys so long to get relevant? And what can I do to help? Well, we don't have a homogeneous congregation. Book discussion groups. Some people will brave ice and wind and snow to come to these things, and others will stay away in plague and in droves because they say it's an intellectual club. It doesn't really sound like church to them. Okay. Actually, I think that photograph looks a little bit better. Now, if we don't create programs that originate with the consumers or with the parishioners, programs that fill their needs, not just needs for salvation, we assume that our programs are going to work toward that end, but needs with which they can more positively identify on a short run basis, we end up with this kind of a problem. A program had been planned, some special celebration, dinner, service, you name it. And we saw this kind of letter coming from the pastors of the church. And I quote, a great deal of planning has gone into this service by members of our music staff. Your pastors have given direction to the service. We also know that unless the members of this church attend, the service, as far as members are concerned, will be a failure. In the eyes of the public, this would be tragic, especially at this time, about 9 o'clock, I guess. Therefore, we are bold enough to urge you to make every effort to be present Sunday afternoon. This is something extra now, okay? We know your hearts will be stirred. Well, now, wait a minute. If they know your hearts will be stirred, why the letter? I mean, why weren't we coming out? Why weren't we telling them we were going to be there? Because it was a program that had to be pushed on our throats. And I said, I'm not going to feel guilty because you didn't do your marketing homework. This is ridiculous. Why not start with whether it will be a success and work backwards? And I don't know if it was a success or not. But the problem here was that they felt at the last minute that it wouldn't be. Now, should that happen? No. You want to have a citywide celebration service and 50 people show up? So again, start with the consumer. Well, let's look at the differences between traditional services or discussions. Different people react to these things differently in the contemporary setting or in the traditional. Here's a traditional situation. Here's a layman in the pulpit or the lectern or wherever. What's he doing there? So why don't we see this? Why do we see this? Different kinds of programs serve different kinds of people and different needs. So let's keep things flexible. I like that better. I don't know who she is, but she looks better than our layman friend. Now, most businesses have competitors in the same industry. RCA bumps into Panasonic, Panasonic bumps into Sony. Congregations, on the other hand, do not have necessarily congregational competitors in the same way. Obviously, a member or a potential member might choose from a number of churches within the same denomination or among a number of denominations, which are, in some sense, competitors. But I think the biggest competitor is, at least in my opinion now, is non-church alternatives. The church's primary marketing task is to sell the church in competition with non-church activities, allegiances, memberships, and so on. I am not, and I don't believe you are, as concerned about losing your members to another church down the street as you are about losing them through boredom or disinterest or an it's too much bother attitude or a what's in it for me attitude. Isn't this the problem? Or have I missed something somewhere? Now it's obvious again, at least to me, that the major task of the church is to more fully utilize the membership that it has. In other words, to generate heat from lukewarm lumps. One method of not only keeping them, but helping them to become alive both spiritually and organizationally is through programs designed to fit their needs, programs with which they can identify both spiritually and psychologically. Now, perhaps the most important focus is on the psychological dimension, the need that it fills now. Let's agree that the spiritual content is there, that that's our overriding goal. All that we need to know about salvation is contained in a book we call the Bible, right? Nearly everyone owns one. Some people own many. How many people read them? Okay, why not? The spiritual content is there, but the motivation to get us to use it is lacking. Something is failing somewhere. The same thing is true, as we pointed out, with many other programs which fail at your church and at mine. Now, the weakness is in not providing the right product to the right people at the right time and at the right price. That's the marketing problem. Let's look at this moment for a moment, component by component. The right product in our case is salvation. We've got the right product, and it's probably a universal product among the churches in our audience here, right? But maybe the package isn't right in order to sell this fantastic product. Packaging, as we said, is very, very important. Two researchers, Allison and Ewell, found that in some taste tests of beer, you can tell I'm from Milwaukee, that people were unable to identify their brand in a blind taste test. Scientifically configured and very well conducted research, the respondents could not identify their brand on any more than a chance basis. But as soon as they were given a labeled bottle test, they could immediately identify the characteristics in their brand that made it their brand. In the blind taste test, they rated the qualities of the beer no better than a chance basis. When the labels were put on, they were able to measure from strongly like to strongly dislike these many variables such as taste and aroma and so on. Okay, what makes the difference? The label does, the package does, and the communication that surrounds it. A beer can be sweet or bitter, light or dark, tangy or flat. It can be brewed to appeal to young people or old people, men or women, snobs or regular guys, workers or professionals. The physical properties can be structured to do the best possible job at meeting the market objectives established by management. But which target market should be aimed at? What kind of a message should we wrap around this series or this list of physical characteristics? This can be determined by the kind of information gathering that I'm suggesting you consider for your congregation. Let's leave the package for a minute. salvation costs us very little, right? Price is a concept, one of the concepts of marketing. And it's not a very expensive commodity for us. But what about the cost in day-to-day terms of your congregation to the members of your church? Doesn't cost much either, does it? So many dollars a year keeps you an active member and keeps the elders off your neck, and that's all it takes. But that's not the only cost. In fact, it's probably not even the relevant cost. What's the most important cost in church membership, activity, involvement? Pardon?
Involvement.
Why is involvement a problem? What do we have to pay to become involved?
Time.
Yeah. That's the thing that we keep running into is that time. I haven't got enough time to do this. I'd like to help you, Pastor, but I just don't have time. Time is a scarce resource. And it's possibly the thing that we have to make people part with far more than other things. I guess money is still a problem. But we'll talk about that in a few seconds. Does anybody really ever have too little time? Do any of us have such a totally packed day that we can't fit something else in, especially if we push something else out? I have found that I have time to do anything I want to do. But I'll have to shove something else away, aside, put it behind me. And I'm convinced that part of our problem is that we're not convincing our members that they should part with time for our cause. So just as the advertiser has to convince you that you need a car, that you'll find money with which to buy that car, maybe at the expense of not buying another color TV or not buying a new home, the church has to convince that same person that his needs are best met. His needs are best met by allocating time or more time to the church. And if you can show him that he is meeting his personal needs, his goals, his objectives, the argument is that he will come across. Just in the case of a good example, if the marketer must find needs which his product can meet, so that scarce resources will be allocated to it by his consumers, his target market. Now we have to determine in the church what needs the church can best meet, and then package them so that the consumer is aware of this need meeting. Now, what are the implications to your church of the changes taking place around us? For example, what's the impact on the Sunday morning service of the apparent trend toward a shorter work week and more leisure time and greater disposable or discretionary income? It was a lot easier, I would think, to pack the house on Sunday before snowmobiles, at least in our state, than it has been lately. The city sort of all hops on the highway and drives north. I don't know why they drive north, because you can't snowmobile on grass. And that's all we have there right now. But it's one more thing that we have to recognize and fight or react to. Or what about the possibility of being able to identify in some fraction of the time you now would have to spend on it, the members of your congregation with children, let's say between the ages of 6 and 10, for what purpose? Well, for planning Sunday schools next year and 2 years and 5 years hence. Well, let's say we want to be able to identify in an instant the parents of preschoolers for some new tot time program. Well, we want to be able to identify and pull out immediately the member families with estimated incomes in excess of $25,000 for some kind of a special debt reduction drive. Or maybe we want to know who are the men in our congregation who are owner managers of businesses, because we're trying to put some kind of a program together and we need to know who they are. Now we're talking about how information can be used. Here are three letters, which don't show you much. For the first time in the history of this particular congregation, the stewardship effort was segmented. A different approach went to different parts of the congregation. Not all men were treated equally, and rightly so, because some were overachievers, some were underachievers, some were just barely alive. So will the same words appeal and generate heat to all those groups? No, they won't. Now let's say for a moment that you agree with what I said. This all must be leading up to something. If you do agree that we've been shotgunning, we haven't been rifling, we haven't been creating the necessary specificity in our program development, then you are ready for some kind of an information system, some kind of information gathering. I have you where I want you. You're a believer in the need for information. The purpose of information is to reduce uncertainty. Now, we'll never get to the point where we have total certainty in these many varied kinds of activities, but we can at least move from total uncertainty to some kind of a risk situation where we can say, if we do these things, we'll be, the odds of our being successful are 7 out of 10, or 0.85 probability, or something like this. Subjective probability, but nonetheless something that resembles less than total uncertainty. I had a client one time who said, we shouldn't advertise during the summer because everybody is on vacation during the summer and nobody reads the magazine. And I looked around me and I saw smoke coming from the chimneys in the factories and people in the rush hour. Where were these people? If they were on vacation, they were working. And maybe magazine readership even went up during the summer because people on vacation took stuff along with them to read at the lake. Point is, he was basing a decision on intuition or myth, not on fact. It's getting close to the 12 o'clock time, but Mark tells me that nobody should panic. Well, let's take church contributions. They're cyclical, right? They go up and down. So we have to be careful when we schedule a fund drive. We can't have it around Christmas because people are pretty busy, and people spend a lot of money at Christmas time, so they really have nothing left. After Christmas, people are broke. Then comes tax time. That's a bad time, too. Or then comes summer, because people are gone, we can't call them, because they're spending money on vacations, they have nothing to spare at that time. And after summer comes, let's get the kids dressed for school time. And after that comes Christmas, and we're out of business. Are these true statements? No. There's a certain amount of truth to them, but what are the facts of the situation? This is mythology. What we need is information, we need facts. We don't need intuition, we don't need assumptions, we don't need beliefs or gut feelings and generalizations. We need facts. Let's look at how we get it. Research. We have two ways of gathering information. One is called research, which is crisis-oriented. We have a problem. We have a problem that we know has to be solved, so we gather information to help solve the problem. How do we do it? There are a number of techniques that you can use. One is observation. Let's simply observe what's going on, record the events as they occur, and then analyze it. Attempt to draw something out of these observations. An example I believe it was called a mission fair at our church. Nobody was bothering our booth because we were the human relations committee, and that was before that was a good thing to be. So people were visiting the other booths, and I had time to kind of wander around. I spent my time observing what kind of people were spending how much time at what kind of booths. What interested people? And what were they, was it the AAL booth with the free pencils? Was it the craft thing from the LWML? What was it? Well, you can learn a lot, simply observing people. Liquid soap came into development that way. A researcher went out, observed housewives washing dishes. He said, don't tell me how you do it, because you don't really know. Show me how you do it. And she took a bar of soap and swished it around in the dish pan and put it back up on the dish, and took the dish and drained it into the dish pan. And the guy kept seeing the same thing happening again and again. He said, why are you doing that? She said, well, that's what makes the really rich suds. The researcher said, why don't we put that goop in a bottle? And they did. And liquid soap preceded liquid detergent, simply through that kind of observational research. Some things you can't ask people. Tell me, without using your hands, how you tie a tie. Describe it to me. Or tell me how you shaved this morning. I can't tell you those things. Can you tell me? You'd have to go through motions. You'd have to recreate it. Some things are best achieved through observation. Or let's use survey research. We've got a dandy example of this coming up in a few seconds. Let's create a survey to ask the questions that we need to know to solve the problems that we must solve. This can be a short-term research project, or it can become part of this long-term management information system that we are looking at today. Some questions can't be asked because they won't be answered honestly. Or they won't be answered because the guy can't really answer the question. He has to check for information. But a lot of questions can be answered. A lot of valuable input can come out of this. Example would be, why do you drive the brand of automobile you drive? What's the logical response to that? I like it. It's dependable. I got a good deal. Does the respondent really understand about image and ego and whatnot. If he does, he probably won't tell you. But chances are he doesn't really understand why he's doing these things. Here's an example, which you don't see very well, of a semantic differential designed to get some kind of a reading on a church letterhead. What did it say to people? Was it a high class or a low class? City, suburban, rich, poor, large, small? This is strictly an example. I would not recommend you use this in your church. Okay, so sometimes we can ask direct questions and get answers. Other times we have to use more disguised methods, such as a semantic differential. Mason Hare asked housewives why did they not use instant coffee at a time when instant coffee was first on the market. And what kind of answer do you suppose housewives gave him? We don't like instant coffee because it doesn't taste good. So Hare created two shopping lists, identical except for one item. One had instant coffee, one had drip ground coffee. And he asked matched samples of women to describe the wife, the housewife, who wrote this list. And he found that the wife with the drip ground coffee was a good wife, a good mother. She got up early to make her husband's breakfast. She was very prudent with her money. The person, not the wife, but the awful person who did the instant coffee list was a spendthrift, lazy, she smoked, and so on. What they were reacting to was the idea that instant coffee was a substitute. Substitute means not as good, it means lazy, shortcut, and so on. But they didn't realize that. What don't you like about the Sunday service? Well, it's too long. Or I don't like the hymns. Come on, now, we can do better than that. Professor from Northwestern found that prior to planning a new sanctuary at a particular Presbyterian church, he found that apartment dwellers favored the new sanctuary while homeowners didn't, through a survey he conducted. And he found that apartment dwellers were younger, less conservative than homeowners in this congregation, and that he could now attack the problem, if he wanted to, of communicating with the people who didn't want it in terms that they could react to favorably. Again, research which is crisis or problem-oriented. Here's an example of a semantic differential. A product, relaxing, not relaxing, little aftertaste, lots of aftertaste. We can compare profiles. We could do the same thing and find that old people felt this way, young people felt this way, and children felt some other way. Or we could compare a number of different formats of services, and by getting this kind of information, do some kind of evaluation. Here's an attempt to gather information which is virtually worthless. This is called a confidential biographical record. Name, address, date of birth, father's name, date of baptism, date of confirmation, children, dates of birth. We turn it over and we find, this is my favorite, hobbies and special interests, which leadership or teaching qualification is professed. Photography, woodworking, arts and crafts, music, theater, sports. What? What is this to do with making managerial decisions in the church or any other place? Okay? It's an attempt to get information, but it's a fairly worthless attempt, and we call it confidential. What's confidential? The fact that I have first aid training? This is illegible. I'm sorry about that. So we won't belabor it. But this is stolen from a study, A Look at Today to Plan for Tomorrow, which is what it's all about. Done by Augustana Lutheran Church in Omaha, and it was a follow-up to A Time for Burning. It was created by Herb Larson, who I'm told is a psychologist, and it's a 200-question questionnaire, which runs it's a long one, a lot of pages. And he's asking questions that are beautifully conceived. They're fantastic. Some of them are simple. How long have you been a member of Augustana congregation? Okay, level of education, that kind of input. But then we're going to get into some of the demographics. Are you a homeowner? And he's got 9 categories of the kinds of things that you could be. Living with one of my children, home for the aged, rent a room. But he's getting a little bit more knowledge about exactly what his people are about. What magazines do they read? Life, Look. Well, we can't talk about them anymore, can you? Saturday Evening Post, all dead. McCall's, Nation's Business. Let's find out who they are. One way to find out is, what do they read? Now we're going to talk about specifically church-type things. The church's annual meeting is a boring function. Strongly agree, agree, all the way over to strongly disagree. People immediately feel at home at Augustana Lutheran. Does this tell you something about what you're doing? Does it tell you something about who they are and how they're reacting? It certainly does. It's plain problem-solving research. But we could take this, the same idea of crisis research, solving particular problems, and we could factor it into an ongoing flow, which is a management information system. We want to know about problems before they occur. Let's not wait for a crisis and then solve it. Let's stop things happening before they take place. Now, management information systems are regular and they are planned. It's a continual gathering of information on a regular basis and dissemination of the results of information gathering to the decision makers in your church. The information from this kind of system can be used a number of ways. One is for control. That may be the most immediate value to anybody. We want to have some kind of continuous monitoring of certain kinds of activities. A logical application in the church might be some instant update of giving performance. We want to know if we're going up or down. Well, let's look at attendance. Well, we can do that manually. But let's take a number of these kinds of things. Attendance, communion attendance, giving, effect of weather on services or whatever. And let's keep this information coming at us. Not once a year and say, gee, we had a bad year last year. Because now it's too late to do anything about it. So, control information is one kind. Planning information is another kind. And once we put out the immediate fire, planning information might be the biggest value of the management information system. Let's look, for example, at information such as the changing nature of the community in which our church is located. Population shifts, aging of the population, racial changes, educational changes as people move in and others move out. What's happening to our environment? That kind of information can be plugged in on a regular basis for planning. Do we need a larger school? Should we sell the school? Are we becoming a primarily blue-collar area in which maybe a third or a fourth of our people are going to be working on Sundays? That means Saturday services or Wednesday services or what? A third and final type of application here is basic information research. We can use the ongoing nature of the information to test decision rules or cause and effect relationships. A relevant example might be the relationship between giving and a stewardship effort, or Sunday contribution and a particular kind of sermon content. This idea of an ongoing system might suggest a lot of sophistication, but it doesn't have to. It can be a very manual kind of program, or it could be highly sophisticated using a computer. And I'd like to spend a minute showing you that the computer application is possibly the way to go, and it's within reach. Here are a couple of manual jobs that were never tabulated. Great surveys, good input for a management information system, but totally irretrievable data. It's in a file somewhere because the guy who was working on it ran out of steam. Here's another one that was the beginning of sort of a personnel file of all the members in the church, something like that confidential thing we looked at a minute ago. And it had the start of being something good, but the people who were designing it didn't realize that more could be added. It could be put on some kind of an automatically updatable thing with immediate retrievability, and now the church would have a totally accessible information file. Any of you men spend time working with ACME files? ACME files? Yeah, do you take a lot of aspirin when you're working with these things? How long would it take you to pull a population pyramid from an ACME? Or some kind of a giving distribution from an ACME file? Enough to keep a retired person busy for a number of weeks, probably. Okay, let's focus for a minute on the area of the information system and financial record keeping. This is just one reasonable example, one place to start. Let's take a congregation of 600 families or giving units. That means we have 600 envelope numbers. Let's divide the week into 13 four-week segments to make comparison easy. And every week, we're going to take our envelopes and we're going to mail them to somebody who's going to put this information on a computer for us. We'll never see it. You know, we don't get involved with that kind of handling at all. But then every fourth week, we're going to ask the computer to do some things for us. We're going to ask the computer to print out a profit and loss statement. You're probably doing that by hand now. We're going to ask the computer to give us an update on our statement of financial position, assets and liabilities. We're going to ask the computer to list by category all our checks, all the checks we've written. We're going to also ask that computer to tell us who's doing what in giving. We're going to have it tell us who is, I think we'll forget about the people who are where they should be in terms of their pledge. But the people who are falling down, let's go after them. Let's find out who they are. Let's get an exception report. Don Hines was delinquent last month. Let's let management know about it now. Let's also talk about the people who are giving more than they said they would. And let's watch this pattern, because if it continues, we ought to talk to this person and say, thank you. Something is really happening, and it's wonderful. We appreciate it. Sometime overgive in a church and see what happens. Nothing, at least in many. Well, now we can provide this very rudimentary information on a timely basis. We can take the people who are busy recording contributions, typing up statements, doing all the manual, frustrating work. We can put these people to work saying, what should we do with this? Here's a management opportunity. Take this information and do something creative with it. Let's take our giving pattern, for example, and let's let this information take our congregation and split into two or three or four groups toward which or toward whom we can specifically tailor stewardship appeals. Group A gets this particular pitch because they are doing these kinds of things. Let's talk to them in terms that are relevant to them. Let's not talk about average per week, because this guy's giving $500 a month. What does this average per week figure mean to him? Nothing. He'll say, boy, I'm beating it by $490. That's great. No, but let's not do that to him. Let's talk to him in a different way. The person who's giving 50 cents every 5 weeks, whether he comes or not, let's talk to him in a different way. And let's tailor a program to communicate the right kinds of things to help people grow. Now, can we do this without the management information concept? Can we do it without a computer? Sure you can, if you have a lot of manpower, a lot of volunteers who want to spend the time doing this kind of thing. Wouldn't it be better to employ these dozen or two or three dozen people in helping to make the kinds of decisions, helping to staff the kind of organization that Dave Lukey was talking about earlier this morning? Let's make it possible for the administrative task of the pastor not to be quite so painful. We can make it possible for things to happen. Now, let's just take our little example, our computer example, with the profit and loss and the exception reports and so on. One step further, we can actually have the computer address the envelopes for us and write the letters if we wanted to. Okay? You know what this would cost? Based on more or less current information, it would cost a church with 600 members about $100 a month. Plus a little bit extra for certain kinds of extra reports. It might cost $1,400 or $1,500 a year once the system is ongoing. Now, if you have a retiree in your congregation, you're paying them $100 a month to do all this stuff sort of as a favor to you, but not quite enough of a favor to make it free. That's $200 a year more than you would pay this man if you were paying him $100 a month. Even if you're paying him nothing, $1,400 is not a lot of money to provide you with current information. Now, we'll take that weekly update on contributions, and we'll put in this whole biographical record. We'll throw in certain attitudinal things. We'll throw in number of children, dates of birth, and so on. And now we can step back and we can plan. We can take our population pyramid today. We can update it in 2 or 5 or 10 year intervals to see what's going to happen to it. We can even throw in fertility rate kind of information with young marrieds who we assume to become married and raise families and talk about what will that do to our church population, assuming no inflow and no outflow. And we can do a lot of things. But what we're doing now is we're making decisions, we're looking at things on a basis of fact, not intuition, not gut feeling, not myth. It's real information. It's current information. What good is it to you in June to find out that you didn't make budget in December? Can you go back and fix it? No, it's too late. Current data makes for decisions that can be used to turn the tide, to adjust to roll with the punches, to avoid costly errors and a lot of slippage. And that's really what it's all about. I think that's as far as we have to go. I wanted to sell a number of concepts. One is that programs will not succeed if they're not directed at the right people in the right manner. We can't direct them at the right people in the right manner if we don't know who they are and what their needs are. We can solve that need by marketing research or management research and the concept of the management information system, which is a data gathering tool which can be used to provide information for intelligent, enlightened program development and planning and execution. One of the benefits of this kind of situation, one, we're making decisions on fact. Two, we're creating programs which fill gaps and therefore which should stand a good chance of succeeding. We're forced to organize and plan, which is something we haven't talked about. We can't gather data unless we have a reason for gathering it. So organization follows from this. Fourth, values, it frees up a lot of time that's spent doing unbelievably painful tasks with very little payout to the organization. And finally, I would hope that it would reduce frustration among clergymen and laymen alike by assuring progress and success rather than endless second-guessing and failure in the kinds of programs that we've seen fail. There's one last cartoon that I think I ought to leave you with. Here's Peanuts. I have a theological question. When you die and go to heaven, are you graded on a percentage or a curve? On a curve, naturally. But how can you be so sure? I'm always sure about things that are a matter of opinion. Well, it's my opinion that adopting this concept of decision-making on fact as implemented by crisis-oriented and ongoing information flow can help programs be unbelievably successful. I have one last thought that if any of you are interested in giving input as to what kind of informational problems you have, I'd like to hear from you. If you'd also like to have the results of a program that I'm developing that will enable you to get information for your church for managerial purposes, let me know. And as soon as it's done, it's yours, free. But in the meantime, if you have input that you'd like to share, I'd love to hear from you, because I've been grappling with this for some years, and it looks like this spring and summer is the time when it's going to be developed and implemented.
$1,400 for a congregation that I have to be an average price. But you were not mentioning the price of the people who would prepare the input.
Yeah. The financial information, the reports, the financial things we use as an example would cost about $1,400 a year, more or less. There would be an initial startup of getting the information into the system, but the annual maintenance of information out and input in would be around $1,400 a year in the example I used. Now, if you get to the question of a total information system with names, addresses, size of family, ages of dependents, attitudes toward a number of different things, whatever it might be, so that you could do long-range and short-range planning, so that you could identify homogeneous segments in your congregation, males between 25 years of age and 35, who are primarily business people, which would be defined by these three or four occupational categories. To get that kind of input in and that kind of output into your hands would obviously cost more. How much more is a function of what you're asking it to do. And I think that the real answer to this would be to, write your shopping list of needs and then communicate with somebody in your community who does this kind of work and say, what would it cost? Here's what we want. Now, the data gathering, getting the information to put into the system, is what I'm working on now. The data gathering act itself would cost, in terms of questionnaires or postage. The instrument, the package, the total system that I'm working on is free, so there's no cost at that point. The implementation is, whatever you do in your own church with it, of course, would cost. But that's a dimension of how much you plan or what you plan on doing with it.
But still, it would be fair to keep because you would probably be less than one extra full-time employee.
Yeah, sure. And more important than that, it's retrievable. We can have it now. What do you want to know? You write the computer service a letter, you call them up, or if you're really first class, you have a little console in your office. and you ask the computer the question immediately, and via a leased phone line, it gives you the answer right on your desk. Now, I don't know what that costs, but if you want to really do it right, the advantage though is the retrievability. Even if you had that full time person, he or she is still faced with these file drawers full of things that aren't retrievable. Now the cost is interesting. Let's take a church of a couple thousand members with a budget of $250,000. If you can improve, and this is just a very small way of looking at it, if you can improve your stewardship activity or your stewardship performance by 10%, you're upping your take by $25,000. If you spend up to $24,999 on an information system that allows you to do that, you're ahead by $1. It's obvious that you wouldn't spend anywhere near that kind of money. So by increasing efficiency, by allowing people to become creative, to use their time more effectively, to help answer questions that can't be answered, it seems to me that a couple of thousand a year would be a fairly nominal cost. You had a question on programming.
What would be the initial, what are some of the costs of that?
I'm always amazed at how inexpensive programming is. Apparently programmers are not as costly as the mystique would imply. What I hope to do with the package we're developing is to find a volunteer church to allow us to implement an information system with their members. I'm hoping my home church will play my games. If not, we'll find somebody who will. I don't know what the cost of programming would be to get the whole thing operational, but I would, once the thing is programmed, it's simply a matter of buying a set of duplicate cards for $5 or $10 and putting them into somebody else's system. And I think once we can get the thing debugged and operational, again, the cost to anybody who would use that is zero, except for the cost of the duplicate cards.
We're right now at the threshold of a market research situation in my church. You mentioned that you're preparing an instrument for us. Mm-hmm. Number one, when is it going to be ready? Number two, what might be using the meantime?
Number one, a year ago I said it would be ready in about a year. And now my hope is that my schedule will allow me to work on the thing so that it would be at the initial stage of use, end of the summer, early fall, mid-fall. So, I don't know, somewhere toward the end of this year. I have to do it fast or somebody else will do it. And all this will have been in vain. In the meantime, what can you do? Somebody else asked at lunch, or before lunch, how do we know, what do we do in the meantime, or how do we implement this? I buy the idea that we want information, but how do I go about it? And my answer was not too brilliant at the moment. I said that really would take another day or two workshop to get into the techniques and so on, to really arm you. But at lunch, we talked about the possibility of recruiting people, if not in the congregation, in the community. I can't imagine that in a city this size, for example, that there wouldn't be a lot of people, Lutheran and non-Lutheran, who wouldn't be tickled to sit down with you as an unpaid marketing researcher to share his ideas with you. You'd still have to do the dirty work of the manual gathering and analyzing and so on, but I would imagine that you could pick up thousands of dollars of free consulting if you would ask. And it never occurred to me that you don't have to have it within your congregation. It could be within neighboring congregations, or it could be people who are totally outside the Lutheran church.
How did you feel about this Omaha, Nebraska questionnaire? How did this relate to what you're going to be doing?
Well, I hope to use a lot of what he has in it with his permission and advice. I hope to get out to Omaha. In fact, I will before I go to the final stage of this thing, but a lot of what's in there is readily usable, as is. Some of the stuff was specifically oriented to the problem faced at his church, and it probably wouldn't be useful to you. Many of the things that he didn't include would be useful to you. So we'll never come up with the ultimate instrument, but his is a fantastic source for a good percentage of the kind of information I believe would be useful in an information system. I would like to, I not only would like to, but will, before we do any final committing on this project, share this with a number of pastors to say, if this information were available to you, would it be useful? Which of these questions would you throw out? Which of the questions that aren't here should be asked? Because I'm attempting to do what I said you shouldn't do. I'm attempting to determine what you need without really asking you what you need. So before we put a system to bed, it will be in some way market tested by the potential user. But I would say that for starters, this Herb Larson's questionnaire is just a fantastic instrument. Makes us green with envy to see some work so beautiful. Yes.
You wanted to say something about changing the feedback?
Oh, yeah. What is your problem specifically?
How can you get legitimate feedback?
By legitimate. Okay, and your particular percentage return was from within a congregation. Okay, this to me would suggest that it was probably a bad questionnaire. Not bad in poor taste, but bad, people didn't see a use to it or a value to it. But what about asking questions in such a way that it offended people or it upset them and they said, nuts to you, I won't bother? Or maybe it just didn't show people the value of responding to it. I'm involved with quite a bit of survey work for commercial accounts, and the best example I can think of was a four-page questionnaire, which is fairly lengthy, sent through the mail to a random sample of Milwaukeeans, asking extremely delicate questions, namely money, income, savings accounts, and that kind of thing. And we had, I believe, something like a 62% response on that, which is unbelievable, because people don't answer those kinds of questions. Well, they do. If you put it in such a way that we can, in some way, this information will benefit you in the long run. Telephone surveys, we normally get 75-85%. And that's a pretty decent response when you're imposing upon people's time. So I think the answer to that question, without knowing the particulars, would be to package it in such a way that people want to participate. You have to show them a benefit.
Yeah.
Well, I you have to educate them, right? You have to communicate to them, and if you fail at that, you're in trouble. I had a little thing that I was going to show, but at that particular point, didn't think it would be a useful exhibit. A questionnaire designed or used by a church to determine when would be the best time for additional services. Normally, how do we decide that? The elders say, I think we ought to have more services, or the pastor says. The elders say, what time do you think we ought to do it? The pastor says, well, I like to watch football, so we can't have it late Sunday. You know, or something like, or the elders say, well, I bowl on Friday night, we don't want it then, do we? And the obvious answer is to ask the people. So for two consecutive Sundays, everybody entering the door receives a questionnaire saying, we have a problem. We believe that additional services would help you, especially in the summer months, to attend worship services. But we don't know when you want them. We don't know when would be the best time for you. So tell us. Was it Sunday or was it weekdays? Was it morning, noon, or night? And it asks other questions like, if you came to a weekday service, would you still come on Sundays, or would that be a replacement, or what? And they had very good feedback. But it said to the people, here's something that you really want to tell us, because it serves your best interest. We want to bend to fit your schedule, but we don't know what your schedule is. And the response was wild. One good way to do it is to hand it out while they're in church and don't let them out. You know, if it's short enough, they can fill it out as they leave. But then you're guaranteed it won't be thrown away or eaten by a small child. And it came completely with a little pencil taped to it, so there was no excuse for not being able to do it. So I think it really depends on the kind of information you're asking and the need that they see. If it's something that's really kind of off the wall and you can't go through the laborious task of explaining the benefit to them of participating, then you have a problem, and those things do arise. I haven't got an answer for that. Other questions? Well, yeah, that's a toughie. In order of response, the best, the order was obviously personal telephone and mail. In order of data, the extent of the data gathered, the preference would be mail. And then I think personal and phone are kind of up for grabs, because if it's asking a lot of information, much of which has to be retrieved, a mail survey is the easiest way to go about it. But then, of course, your response rate goes down. Anonymity is nice in certain kinds of questions, and personal is tough there, and phone is almost as bad. The feeling that they know who I am is still there. I have had great success with paper and pencil kinds of surveys. Mail questionnaires, or a combination where a human-type person drops off the questionnaire, explains it briefly, and indicates what should be done, and then asks for it to be mailed back, or it'll be picked up at a later time. It's hard for me to understand why response rates wouldn't be high within a congregation if it's a useful instrument and if the people have been properly prepared for it. Because they have a commitment to the congregation much more so than a random sample respondent would have, and something that is not really part of their life at all. Well, for the kind of questions I'm thinking about for the information system, it has to be signed. We have to know who these people are. For the kind of thing that Augustana did, that was assigned. That asked for name and address, too. Now, I don't know what his response rate was on that, but I think people were enough involved in the problem that they wanted to complete this thing. Normally, if you're asking sensitive data, a totally anonymous questionnaire is the best bet. But I think it's a little bit humorous, the things that we consider sensitive, which the respondents don't. You can't ask income, you sure can. Dr. Kinsey did a pretty good job of asking other kinds of questions, and he had a pretty good response rate. We have to doubt his reliability, I guess, of his work. But you can talk about the craziest things, and people, if it's done right, will get into it. I think the biggest problem, and I don't want to mislead you by saying that this is really an easy thing and you can turn the world around by asking a few questions. The toughest part is asking the right questions in the right manner. I've seen sociologists create unbelievably bad questions, leading, loaded, ambiguous, questions with multiple answers, and so on. Every time I do a survey, I end up with a couple of buttes that I am ashamed of and wish I hadn't done, but you don't know it until it's too late, because it wasn't properly pre-tested, and by George, everybody's in a hurry. But invariably, you ask a question that's not A or B, but it's A or B or both. Well, what do you do with that? Well, you didn't ask it quite correctly. Raising survey research questions is a nasty job, and it really requires professional treatment. Otherwise, you end up with information, but it's pretty spurious information. Yeah?
You say that question is a tough job. What I would say is that the question is really slurring something that is different from that one.
Gio, I had an exhibit that I could have brought along, but it never occurred to me. There are all kinds of biases that come into survey research. There are order biases, that obviously phrasing makes a difference, and so on. But we ran an experiment at the university. We replicated somebody else's experiment, which was really a split run. The same questions asked two different ways. And in both cases, the questions looked perfect. They were honest, well-written questions. But the difference between question 1A and question 1B guaranteed the directions of the answers to be totally opposite. For example, do you believe that federal aid to education should be increased, yes or no? That question had an overwhelming yes. 98% said yes. Somebody, the match sample said, do you believe federal aid to education, which will be funded by increased taxation to citizens, should be increased? The same percentage said no. Well, which is the better question? They're both perfect, but they're both asking, the implications are vastly different, right? Well, these kind of subtleties are tough. Or in a series, a multiple choice situation with number data, categories, people tend to either group in the center or at the ends, I don't recall which. With verbal information, they tend to do the opposite. In a choice of five, people either pick one or five in one instance or the center in the other. I don't recall which does which at the moment. So the guidelines become, a textbook of 400 pages. And that's where I'm letting it down. You say, but you said we could do this. There's something missing, and that's some of the mechanics of doing it and doing what you think you're doing, getting information that you really believe you want in a way that guarantees you honest, valuable information, not just misinformation. You can do a lot of research and come up with a lot of bad data and make decisions on that data, on those data. Yeah, if you're in a hurry to do these things, reading a book about it or taking a course, you all have time for taking a course in survey research, or maybe, again, finding somebody who's willing to clean up your questions for you. Simple example. We have a problem to solve. Here are 20 or 25 questions that we believe should be answered to help solve our problem. And now you find one of these good souls who will help you by rephrasing questions, by reordering them, by knocking out superfluous questions. Example, there's a rule that says never ask a question that can be answered internally. You never ask a question that can be answered by the interviewer. You don't ask, are you male or female? There's a box that says male or female, and you check the one that applies. You, the interviewer, does. And so on. So a professional could help doing that kind of polishing for you. Again, you're stuck with the analysis, but if the thing is begun properly, the odds of you having good data are much greater. So I think there's an easy way. I don't have a 30-page handbook that would help. In the development of this information system, I would hope that the end product would have not only instruments to be used, but also guidelines as to how to use them, and even recommended analyses. You've got these variables and these variables. Why don't we do some cross-tabs? Age versus certain attitudes, or attitudes against certain performances, and so on. I would never take a package like this and say, here, figure it out, live it up. My goal would be to make it an implementable system, one that you could read and understand and plug into quickly. That doesn't help you now.
This is helpful because the question is not just what's the easiest way of doing it,
yeah.
It's how hard it got to do it. You're doing some of the questions, not just the real simple things.
No.
You're doing this really worth objectively.
The shortest distance between knowing what information you want or having a good feeling for it and getting good information is probably to borrow a professional. And see if that will get you the results you need. The idea of going out and taking courses or doing extensive reading, I think, is one of those idealistic things that we're just not going to do, right? I'd love to have about 20 more hours of statistics, but I'll never get it because I really don't want it that badly. The cost is just too great. So we allow or we rely on other people to help us out of problem areas.